thank you very much. I'm very flattered to see such a large audience. I know some of you are here because otherwise your grades would be lowered. And others are here because they know me since the year one. Some are here because they're my relatives. And others are here because they're sons and daughters of friends of mine. So I shouldn't be so surprised that there is such a large audience. But I always am, because I have a feeling there's so many more interesting things to do than to go hear another lecture in a place where you already have to listen to too many. But I'll try and make it somewhat interesting if I can, because I know that an occasion like this is an occasion for learning, but even more than that, it's an occasion for entertainment. Have a few laughs, get to know somebody new, not always the same old face, and just generally have a good time, if that's possible in a situation where, what is it, about 8 feet separate me from you, and our backs are away from each other. I don't like the normal format for this kind of thing, where you know, an artist comes and brings a bunch of slides, half of them are upside down, and then he says, "This one is 6 foot in length and 4 foot in height, and I painted it in 1968. And this one is 5 foot in length and 6 foot in height, and I painted it in 1969, and so forth." I've been to too many of those things myself, besides which they smack to me of self-promotion. And when it comes to self-promotion, I'm second to none, because I brought all my old catalogs here for you. Which is much better than a slide, because it means you have to lug it around with you for a while. And maybe some of you, if you like something you see there, can even cut it out and put it on your studio walls, or you know, make something more permanent out of it than a slide could ever be. Besides which, I don't like slides in general. They never give you the sense of a painting. Reproduction doesn't either, but at least you don't expect a reproduction to give you that sense. A slide is always much more beautiful than a painting can ever be. Besides which, it's dematerialized light. And painting is really an object. And I'm always frustrated. I'm sometimes on these committees where you have to hand out a prize to somebody or invite them to go stay at Yaddo or some equally pleasant place, and they send you 3,000 slides to look at in one evening to decide, you know, who's going to be invited to get this prize. And at the end of the evening, I always say, well, I should have thrown them all in the air and let them land, and then pick the ones that land close to the middle. Because you really can't tell anything from slides, or else what you do tell is the wrong thing. You can tell what it is, and that's about all. So I'd much rather have this catalog for you, which has a few words in it too. In fact, some of them have words that I wrote, and of course, they're bound to be much more suspect than anything anybody else writes, because the artist is notoriously the last person to know anything interesting to say about his own work. So instead, I wrote out a lecture, and the way I came about this title, Restlessness and Stability in Present-Day Painting, was because I wanted to appeal to the academic audience. I don't only want a group of art students and artists to come, but I'd like the world at large to get interested in art. That's really what's needed today. Art needs to be taken out of the circle of the aura of being a specialty and be reinserted into life as it's being lived, and be taken out of this sacred cow aspect which it has, and become something ordinary, extraordinary in one sense and ordinary in another. And the way to do that, I think, is to integrate it into the cultural history of the period, the cultural history which we're living. And that's what in my talk I tried to do. Of course, every time I sit down to write a talk, which I haven't done very much, because most people have had enough sense not to invite me, the times that I've had to sit down and write one of these things, I've always gotten terrible stage fright. And I've decided, well, I'm not a scholar, I'm not a historian, I better start reading some art history. So before this talk, you have to imagine me reading through tomes and tomes of art history to prepare for this talk. And finally, I came upon one article in a textbook on art history called Readings in Art History that maybe some of you even use. And there's an article in there by a famous recent art historian and art critic named Harold Rosenberg, with whom I totally disagree on the important issues. I mean, the important issues to me are what's the content of a painting? And Harold Rosenberg thinks that the content of a painting is history. And I think that the content of a painting is form. And he makes fun. He actually, in that article, makes fun of people who think that the content of painting is form. And he's so elegant that I kept underlying things that he said in this article. And finally, I copied three quotes out of his article. And one other, I was determined to use those quotes in my talk. They were so good. So one other way of labeling this talk would be a lecture built around three quotes by Harold Rosenberg. Another thing that happens to you when you sit down to write out a lecture, as infrequently as I do, is you decide that you're going to unburden yourself completely. And all the things that are itching and that are hurting and that are on your mind, and especially the things that you've got to get off your chest because you feel upset about them, those go into your lecture first, you know. So I started writing all these things out, and I read it over, and it sounded terribly bad-tempered to me. Now, nobody wants to sound bad-tempered, you know, in front of a nice bunch of people. So I started again, and but I was determined to put some of these bad-tempered things in. And so I did put them in, and I wrote the lecture, and I started out with a sort of a large overview, and then I had a little section of bad-tempered things, and then in the course of writing it, I got so exhausted that at the end, I sort of worked myself right through this period of bad-temperedness, and then I became like a god in Olympus above the battle when I was finished. And now when I read over the lecture, I see there's absolutely nothing controversial in it at all. And you're all going to walk home just as ignorant as you were when you came here, as unencumbered by heavy prejudices as you were before, because I ironed them all out so that finally the result is neutrality. All right, this is the end of my informal introduction. I'll tell you when the formal introduction ends. Restlessness and stability. You, the public for art, and I, the maker of it, have one overriding thing in common. We're constantly in danger of becoming totally confused. There are two reactions we can choose: to try to make sense out of the situation or to turn away from it in apathy. As an artist, I don't have the luxury of the second alternative, although there are colleagues who in their weaker moment tend toward it. Artists try to make a modicum of sense out of the situation by a number of strategies. One will work himself or herself into such a whirlwind of creation that the outside world hardly exists. Another artist may close his mind to all alternative modes but his own, and find good reasons to consider the rest to be deranged or at best mistaken. And a third, among which I count myself, will attempt to find his way in the confusion, perhaps even going so far as to discover patterns underlying it, based on whatever scraps of psychology, cultural history, and personal experience he has available. Now, I'm of course not a scholar, as I told you already, as you well know, as you can determine in the course of this talk, nor an art historian, and don't think that I don't often wish I were, especially when the rare moment comes when I have to sit down to write a lecture to be presented before a group such as this. But I do have one strong advantage. Whatever ideas I come up with, I can test immediately against an iron standard. Do they help or hinder my art? Do these ideas make me stronger or weaker as an artist? As Harold Rosenberg has put it, first quote, "In our time, those who are content merely to paint pictures or to contemplate them are out of touch, either through choice or ignorance, with the dynamics of creation in the arts. Their norm is to be found in the canvases and picture gazers at the Washington Square Outdoor Art Show. Art, including its appreciation, has come to be an area of conflicting powers." I am particularly aware of this truth, having witnessed and to a degree suffered through 20 years of that conflict, a period during which I and all the painters who worked in a related vein were shoved rather rudely into the shadow. After basking in the 50s in the sunshine of the art world's benevolent attention, those 20 years of comparative oblivion were, however, salutary in that I was forced to think. Ideas, or rationalizations, if you will, can be very useful to explain any changes in fortune, to tide one over periods of low morale. It is no accident that some of my ideas, which I felt were tentative then, can now be shared without even a hint of shame. The famous pendulum has swung again. We are no longer under duress. As Rosenberg wrote, periods of reaction against yesterday's enthusiasms seem to be growing constantly shorter. Even my appearance here before this assemblage of the informed is due not merely to my brothers being a notorious character around campus. He denies any responsibility for my presence, and I believe him to a degree. A few years back, the decorum which governs the public arena would have consigned me to utter privacy. My art was so unfashionable as to lack respectability, or else it was so respectable as to lack seriousness. So I'm happy to be here for a number of reasons. I've herewith completed my more formal introduction, and still we're not talking about stability, and some of you may be becoming restless. Rather than generalize first, I'll now begin the meat of this lecture with some personal reminiscences, for which I must regress all the way to my high school days. I attended the High School of Music and Art in New York, of which I'm sure some of you have heard. One of my best friends there was a boy who later became a well-known avant-garde artist named Alan Capra. While in high school, we shared many interests: push-ups, girls, how to draw a horse, as well as more modern and generally warlike modes of locomotion. However, we parted company on how to deal with teachers. I used to think that to make any class bearable, the teacher needed a lot of help. One had to laugh at the jokes, be interested, ask questions, generate a bit of class spirit. Alan, on the other hand, tried to make the teachers really earn their money. He circulated scurrilous notes, whispered noisily to his neighbors, and launched paper airplanes into the classroom atmosphere when the teacher's back was turned. When called to account, he was rude and upset the teachers even further. I used to try to influence him to have a heart, but of no avail. In his own home, things were no easier. Each meal would occasion noisy disagreements between Caprow Jr. and Caprow Sr., while Ma Caprow would try to make everyone feel guilty for not overeating while all this was going on. That the food was generally served cold and greasy didn't improve matters. Although the elder Caprow was a successful lawyer, I think one could safely describe Alan's antecedents as culturally deprived. Tradition here meant hypocrisy and inconvenience, and authority incomprehension. After a couple of difficult years at college, Alan finally convinced his father to let him go to art school, and he nearly had to die before that happened, with ulcers, peritonitis, and complications. He attended the Hoffman School, which was a famous art school at the time, with the thought of becoming a painter. He stayed only a year. He was respectful to Hoffman, even admired him. Hoffman himself was something of a rebel, and he tried to paint in the mode we were all practicing at the time, though he became easily dissatisfied. "I can't believe in my painting," he complained. "Every stroke I make, I know where it comes from. This one is Bonnard, that one Kokoschka, the next Matisse." He generalized his malaise, proclaimed that, quote, "painting is dead," unquote, and over the next few years went on to invent that mixture of performance and installation to which he gave the name Happenings. One of the more famous of these was held right here in Cornell. I'm giving you a piece of college history now. At the time, it generated its share of controversy. I'm sure some of you can remember. Alan's original idea had been to tumble 500 empty oil barrels into the gorge from a high place on campus. This proposal placed well-meaning people into a quandary. Should they oppose it on environmental grounds or be in its favor for reasons of artistic freedom? He was finally refused permission and reluctantly substituted a different work, wherein an old jalopy was hauled into a chemical landfill covered with 200 or 300 pounds of raspberry jam, which a group of students, girls I believe, were invited to lick off, which they did, surrounded by an astonished throng. I've tried to be objective in this account of my old friend, although I've probably not been totally successful. I imagine I'll be even less successful in trying to be objective in the following account of a contrasting figure, this figure being me. I grew up in Germany, a Jew under Hitler, although in spite of that, I remember my childhood fondly. Ours was a privileged family where everyone played instruments, collected pictures, and generally considered the life of the mind as a normal and necessary part of living. The food was always served hot and wasn't greasy at all. One member of each generation had traditionally had a career in the arts. The house, with its traditions and values, was a sanctuary. Outside on the street were the Nazis, the Hitler Youth, the frightening world of institutionalized hatred. I grew up in a popular culture from which I was totally excluded, by law in most cases. Medieval Jews, or Jews of the Russian Pale, were similarly excluded from the official culture in which they lived and thrown back upon their own traditions. In my own case, the Jewish traditions had long been abandoned, but the European high culture was still available, and on this I lived. I skipped my high school experiences. Safe to say that I was a good student, enjoyed going there. At the Hoffman School, which I attended with Alan, I became Hoffman's assistant and the school monitor. My attitude toward this great teacher was one of awe and utter respect. Besides, I sensed that he was the bearer of great secrets, even mysteries. He seemed to possess the key which unlocked the narrow passage which connects the art of the past, on which I was nurtured, with the difficult art of the present. He told us that the same concerns animated Rembrandt and de Kooning. Hoffman students were encouraged to study the old masters and the great moderns, not so much for what each had that was unique, but more for the formal qualities, the structure, which to Hoffman seemed to lie at the center of the meaning of the work. We were encouraged to recapitulate the history of modern art in our own paintings. To be influenced was no disgrace, it was strongly encouraged. I've posed these two descriptions to indicate two strongly contrasting types and their genesis. Alan is, of course, the embodiment of the restlessness of my title. The avant-gardist, who's at odds with the world as he finds it, in love with change, unable to find a nurturing tradition. D.H. Lawrence spoke of him in his studies in classical American literature, where he describes that American who declares, henceforth, be masterless. The traditionalist, in his turn, inhabits a climate of relative stability, and if none exists, he invents it. And art is a good mode for inventing stability when none exists. For him, individuality is a byproduct, not a goal. The goal is to bring his work, and through his work, his entire personality into a realm of structures and certitudes. Historically, these types have existed side by side, and it's very difficult, probably impossible, to claim greater value for one over the other. An artist like Duchamp has been important in hinting at new possibilities, opening up new areas for artistic exploration. But an artist is judged by his works, not only by his contribution to a dynamic of change. Is the work of Duchamp better than that of Bonnard, to take a foolish example? I hardly think so. Is Warhol greater than Hopper? Almost like comparing apples and neckties. Each fills a different need. The avant-garde artist satisfies those of us who need constant challenge, who are easily bored, those who hate to linger. To illustrate with a story. In the early 50s, there was much enthusiasm among the young artists of my acquaintance for the new composers, Cage, Feldman, Brown, Volpe. I don't for a moment claim that we were a truly informed audience, but we nevertheless felt that we somehow were in harness together and acted as loyal groupies, providing a public for their concerts in whatever obscure halls they were then being held. During one of these concerts, the conductor, having just conducted Varese, felt it necessary to reward the audience after this strenuous experience by playing a less difficult piece. And now, he announced, I want to play a piece you will all understand. One of the artists shouted indignantly, we want to hear something we won't understand. The traditional artist, in turn, satisfies the public's need for continuity. The need to freshen our insights into what we already seem to know, to have that brought up to date, and to separate it from that which is truly irrelevant and purely nostalgic, like monarchy or the art of military horsemanship. One further point, traditional art is a popular art. Advanced art seems to be more glamorous, and one reads more about it because I suppose it's easier to write about. But the greater part of the public who, quote, consumes art likes traditional art. It goes almost without saying that by far the greatest number of artists practice traditional art, debased though most of it may be. The tradition constantly absorbs the avant-garde work of yesterday. As the French Academy, to take an example, began to prominently exhibit the Impressionists about one generation after they first surfaced, they ceased being the avant-garde. Matisse, a revolutionary in 1906, can now be seen to be a logical extension of Impressionism, and so forth. I'm not saying that all movements and artists are inevitably thus absorbed. They have to be seen to be part of art's mainstream. The vorticists, luminists, dadaists, even the futurists are still not so absorbed. They are interesting primarily as ideological gadflies. Their work didn't turn out to be intelligent enough, or better, maybe it wasn't good enough. And we can see this after two generations of distance from it. Thus far, I've tried to be above the battle, talking in generalities, dealing with categories and the past. It's only when I regard the ideological battleground of today in the art world that I can't avoid a note of indignation or at least querulousness. Today, as we all well know, the avant-garde has become entrenched as the official ideology in the art world. How this has come about is something to be explained by a cultural historian. What is clear is that the traditionalists, numerically by far the larger, are mostly on the defensive, worried sick that they are truly, as their antagonists claim, part of the scrap heap of history. I rather think that it's unlikely that we're part of the scrap heap of history. I think the avant-garde phenomenon may well be an aberration, from which, however, we continue to suffer, because it introduces distortions into the culture at large. Take the museums. They used to be the recalcitrant slowpokes, opening their doors to the new only grudgingly and long after the novelty had worn off, and I believe this conservatism is appropriate to their real function. Recent history has here taken its toll. As Rosenberg phrased it, quote, "One thing had been learned from the notorious mistakes of the past 100 years, and the lesson was thoroughly confusing. It was that no new work, no matter how senseless, repulsive, or visually vacant, could be rejected without running the risk that it would turn up one day as a masterpiece of the era." Unquote. The museums have learned their lesson well. They flip-flop with a vengeance. Now they beat the bushes for the latest thing and try to be the first in discovering new fashions and new talent. Without the corrective of time, it's no surprise that the museums are as often wrong as right in their prophecies. A powerful museum, however, can do much to make its prophecies, wrong or right, self-fulfilling. The mere fact that an artist is being promoted by a strong institution like the Museum of Modern Art or the Whitney ensures a lot of attention for that artist. Critics are hired to write catalogs, the newspapers have to do a story, and a large crowd of people will see the work in the intimidating setting of an official installation. A few years later, the truth comes out. As Rosenberg said, and this is the last quote, I promise. Art comes to be the result of a balance among the things it is asserted to be by the self-elected individuals who create it and devote themselves to it. A balance of the things it is asserted to be. But before this balance comes about, much may have been officially advanced, which is trash, and the public, which usually hasn't a clue, ends up being further alienated. I strongly believe that museums are not enhanced by these unseemly contests of the untried against the tried. The marketplace is the proper place for these contests. In corrupting, or in the very least confusing, the public's taste through its control of museums, The official avant-garde does equal or greater harm wherever it controls the education of future artists in art schools or art departments.